Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age. Kasia Maynard is joining us today. She's the head of research and editorial at WorkTech Academy. She's a leading voice in workplace research currently at WorkTech, with a background in multimedia journalism and an MA in urban design and planning from the University of Sheffield. She brings a unique lens to the evolving dynamics of workspaces. Kasia's work delves into the intersection of people and technology in place. She's led research projects for global clients and contributed to discussions on topics ranging from AI in the workplace, which is a common conversation topic here, to the future of urban work environments. Recognized as one of the Workplace Leaders Top 50 in 2024, Kasia continues to influence the discourse on workplace innovation and design. Welcome, Kasia.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we always start every episode with a question around what is your weird work moment of the week. So what about you, Dan?
So somebody reached out to me for advice on how to start a podcast. And I was like,
oh, little do they know how little we know about that.
Right. And I was like, me? Really? But that was really cool. And it was so nice. We're so early in our journey, but it was really nice to, you know, hear from somebody who's early in that stage. And I think, you know, around the techie bits and all of that, but I was just like, the biggest piece of advice I can give you is to just do it.
That's a good piece of advice. It's often the biggest most important piece of advice, I think.
What's yours?
Mine is very much around AI, which is, again, becoming a very common topic here, as you can imagine. I have actually spent a lot of this week really delving into how to use tools like ChatGPT. And in the course of this week, I've managed to get ChatGPT to take the role of a CEO of a specific organization, of which I've sort of detailed all the information. And then I've had it interview me about a brand strategy that I'm developing and force me to sort of think about it very much from the client's perspective in a way that I wouldn't have been able to before. So that was really interesting. I also created a custom GPT. I've created a producer for this podcast, which is very exciting. Haven't got it quite working the way I want to, but I can see the potential, which is great. And then the final way that I used it, and I'm just going to take a minute to tell this story because it had me in hysterics this week. So after doing all this stuff with work, in the evening, my daughters who are 13 and 10 said they wanted me to read them a story before bed. Now, this is a sweet thing that they still want me to do this from time to time, but it's also a challenge because we've got rid of all of our kids' books, so we have very few things to actually read. And so I said, well, you know, my laptop's still sitting there open. Why don't you write to ChatGPT and say, I was inspired by you, Dan, and tell it that you want it to write you a bedtime story for 13 and 10-year-old girls. And so my 10-year-old went in there and she said she wanted it to write them a story. She said their ages, it had to be family friendly. Those were her words. And then she said, I want it to be about a high school romance. And I want it to have a plot point in the middle that we don't expect and a cliffhanger at the end. And so without retelling you the entire story, it started off with the story of these two girls who had been friends for a couple of years and had fallen in love. And I thought, well, that's nice because some of the things we've heard about kind of embedded bias, maybe not completely playing out the way we expect. And it's a really sweet story. It's set in some sort of region, I think, of the US, felt maybe sort of Pacific Northwest, lots of forests and rivers and things like that. Really sweet story, kind of this like verbal montage of how they're getting to know each other, how they profess their deeper feelings to each other. And then all of a sudden one turns to the other and she says, why have you been a little bit distant lately? And the other one goes, well, it's because I'm in witness protection. And I've been in witness protection for the past couple of years, and my real name is Sophia, and there's a crowd of people after me. And right after she says this, there's a bunch of hooded figures emerge from the woods, and she says, and now you're in danger too. And the hooded figures start pursuing them, and then one of them takes off his hat, and it's the brother of the other one, and then it says, they say, come with me, and cliffhanger. And I will never know how this story ends.
God. Wow. I mean, Netflix, so if you're listening to this podcast, please come and tame.
Took such a ridiculous, hysterical turn. And the whole story was probably It took probably about 45 seconds to read. So a lot was crammed into that. So
So
yeah,
much
sorry, a bit of a
drama.
long one today, but just thought this is an interesting journey I'm having with AI and its potential to bring some creativity to my life. So yeah.
Love
And
it.
what was your weird work moment of the week?
I think mine has been because I'm usually based in London and this week I'm in New York. I've had a lot more face-to-face meetings than I would ever do in London. And it's so funny because a lot of the meetings I do are with people in the same city as me, but I'll always choose to do Teams or Zoom. And now I'm in New York. Like, let's meet face to face. I'm in the city. I'll come and see you. I'll come to your offices. And at the end of every meeting, we've all been like, this was really nice. I feel energized after this meeting. I feel great. Why don't I do this in London ever anymore? It's always very, very virtual in your own town. And then as soon as I travel somewhere, you make a little bit more of an effort to see people in person. So it's been, I think for me, it really highlighted how much I miss the in-person meetings and traveling to different meetings. And when I am in London and when I am sort of in my day-to-day, yeah, I thought
Yeah,
that was a bit weird.
it's like
No question.
novelty almost, isn't it? It's the novelty part of it. And I didn't expect you to say you felt really energized purely from the last time it happened was COVID, obviously. And we had to prepare people, the company that I was at the time, we had to do employee briefings because we phased everybody back in. And people would come in for the week and feel so exhausted from the social interaction. They all thought they were ill and had COVID after it. But we're like, no, it's because you're not used to so much human interaction in person. You're actually just really tired and your social battery's low. And it reminded me of that. And I just like, is your social battery low, or actually are you on the flip reverse and you're like, no, I'm buzzing off this connection?
I think, well, it's both. So I'm coming to the end of my trip today. I've been here for a week. My social battery is quite low now, but I think I know because it's a finite period of time. I felt really energized and I don't get the opportunity to speak to these people in person all the time. So from the conversations we were having and the weather's been nice here. So we just sat in the park and had a catch up with a coffee in the park. And it's not just sitting in a conference room or sitting in your house or, talking through a screen. So it has felt energizing. I don't know if it's the weather. I'm partial to a bit of sunshine and a walking meeting. So yeah, I do think if my life was this in London constantly, then yeah, maybe my social battery every week would be a bit more drained. But once in a while, I think meeting in person, doing a kind of walking meeting and feeling the energy of someone else as well, it does energize me, I think. Yeah. And I would consider myself introverted as well at some point.
You'd get just different vibes, don't you? You understand people on a different level. You kind of read their body language. I mean, there's all this stuff around kind of pheromones and things like that. You know, things are happening in the room that just can't happen behind a screen. So, yeah, it's great that you got to do that and have some sunshine. Although we've had quite a lot in London as well this week. So,
So I hear.
yeah. So, the other question we ask is, are you where you thought you'd be at this point in your career, and why or why not?
That is such an interesting question because if you asked me when I was 18, I'd say no because I was hoping to be an archaeologist. And at 22, then I went into journalism. I was hoping to be a travel journalist. And then at 23, I started pursuing kind of writing and journalism in the future of work. And I fell in love with it instantly. And so for the last decade, when I've been researching and writing and I've been evolving that love for the subject, yeah, I think I am where I would like to be at this point in my career, kind of heading up a department around research and editorial. I have a lot of license to just dive into topics that I'm interested in. I pursued the urban design master's while I was doing this job as well, just because it was something that I was really interested in. And I've been lucky that my career has allowed me to be flexible in just sort of going down some avenues of tangential subjects to do with the future of work. And so where I am now, I maybe it's not where I expected I'd be, but I'm very happy with where I've landed with it. And I think there's so much more to be researched on this topic. There's so much more to be spoken about on the future of work and all the different facets. So I'm excited by it. I feel energized by my role. I've got a lot of energy today, apparently, but
The thing. So I just want to talk to you about this moment in work, right? So you've been looking at work for a number of years, and I'm sure, as you said, you've been looking at the future of work. Does it feel like the future is now here, or is there something different about this moment that feels like it's just all the more relevant and topical to be discussing work?
Yeah, do I feel like the future's here in some aspects? Yes. I think, you know, and this is not a new thing to say, but before the pandemic, a lot of these shifts were in gear anyway. They've just been accelerated by the global pandemic, and we've heard that phrase a lot in the last 5 years. But there are some things that haven't materialized, and some sort of dead ends and red herrings that we've sort of gone down, like Darren mentioned, sort of the metaverse and things like that. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, that was a huge, this is where the future of workplace is heading. You know, some organizations bet the houses on that, but made some huge investments for something that didn't really materialize. But other things like workplace flexibility, autonomy, the way that we think about work, and the conversations that we're now having around, you know, what is work, where is work, those kind of questions, I think, you know, yeah, that's pretty revolutionary to where we were, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. So in some ways, yeah, I think the future, we're definitely kind of, you know, talking about the future of work, and it is kind of here. And in other ways, we're pretty far away from what I think we could be talking about.
So as you said, the pandemic has obviously accelerated some things and put some things into sharper focus, and then also shifted the sort of plates underneath work in quite substantial ways. As a result of that, we've seen some new models emerging. We did an episode on the 4-day work week. What other models are you seeing as kind of coming out of that pandemic period, or even things that were starting to happen before and have just been accelerated by that stage?
It's interesting. In terms of models, we were looking at, we did a kind of a trend report at the end of last year that looked at the kind of four strategies or five strategies that workplaces were taking to do with like the strategies that they've been doing since the pandemic. Sorry. So we kind of came up with these six typologies. And I think the 4-day work week sort of fits into that as some of them as a model. But we spoke about the choice champions, and there were people that were championing employee autonomy and choice. And that was kind of the model that was really sort of around well-being and engagement and things like that. On the opposite side of the spectrum, we have the resolute returners. They're the people like Amazon and JP Morgan, and, you know, the people are saying 5 days a week is the only way I can conceive a future of work to be. Therefore, you will be coming back to the office full time. You have people like the well-being watchers. So that's another interesting model. So before the pandemic, I think well-being was a bit of a superficial gloss on top of work. You know, you come back to the office, people won't take substandard air quality. They don't want dirty workplaces. They're much more conscious about that. So the well-being of employees is risen to the top of corporate agendas now, and they're thinking about it in much more meaningful ways. And so we're seeing that as a shift. Another model was, or a strategy was, these kind of shapeshifters. So we looked at specifically at real estate. So at the beginning of the pandemic, we saw lots of people claiming that they were going to cut space or cutting space. Yeah, that has happened. But we've also seen a lot of organizations extend their spaces as well. Look at places like JP Morgan and Google in New York. They've, you know, they've made a pretty public statement that they're going back to the office. They've made these huge campuses here. And then the other ones, you know, we had the kind of digital transformers, and these were the beginning of the pandemic, better the houses on metaverse. And now we're really just talking about AI. Metaverse kind of isn't really in our daily conversations anymore. The data models as well that people have taken. So, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, again, it was much more what's happening with occupancy and what can we learn from our data? What is our data? And now it's, how can our data inform decisions? How can we start being more predictive with what we know about the office and what we know about people, and making those experiences much more personalized? So those were the six strategies, and some people cross over multiple strategies, but that was the way we kind of made sense of the structures that were happening at the moment and the shifts that were happening at the
moment. Are there any, is there research or data that shows which of those models people are generally preferring and which are most successful, or does that kind of vary based on sector and company size and culture and things like that?
It does vary, but there are general shifts as well. So we identified those six models at the beginning of the pandemic, and then we revisited them in December 2024. And so we looked at some of the shifts, and at the beginning, the choice champion group, that was the group that was most vocal, and they were saying, we've gone remote. We're talking about people like Spotify, Atlassian, those kind of companies, and really hanging their hat on remote working. That has shifted. We've now seen a shift where hybrid was actually and is actually very complex, and people still don't know how to do it successfully. And so they're kind of migrating back to in-office, in-person work. And so I think that's been one of the key kind of shifts in that demographic, that hybrid just became a bit too difficult to manage or to do, and there's no blueprint for it. And actually, there is a blueprint for coming into the office because we've been doing that for 100 years. So that was maybe the biggest shift we saw between, yeah, choice still exists, but not in the same way that we were talking about it 5 years ago at the beginning of the pandemic.
And how are these things, these shifts, impacting cities and central business districts and places where people used to go into work all the time? What are we seeing happening there in response to this?
Well, at the beginning of the pandemic, we obviously saw a lot of people move out of the city, and I'm specifically talking about London at this point, because that's my sort of lived experience. But having been in New York this week and the conversations I've had, it seems to be a trend here as well. People moved out of Manhattan, people moved out of the kind of key workspaces. So again, looking at London and New York, I was talking to someone yesterday and they said Wall Street is a dead end now. There's nothing going on in Wall Street, and it's much similar to Canary Wharf in London. You know, if people aren't going to the office every day to work, and those are two very specifically designed places for office working and for financial institutions to work, if that's not happening anymore, then those places become dead. And actually in New York, where is an area that's much more successful now, is the Hudson Yards area, because it has the High Line, because it has new coffee shops, the buildings are new, there's terraces, it feels much more vibrant there. Similar to London, the city of London, now you see construction happening all the time, there's more amenities. So yeah, while the data might suggest that we're not back to sort of pre-pandemic levels, the way that we use the city, and I think the way people are coming into the office and showing up to the office is different. People expect a higher level of external amenity. They expect better workplaces. They don't want to go and sit in a high rise old building in Canary Wharf where their amenities are, you know, generic kind of coffee chains and, you know, not. And I know they're doing actually a lot of work in Canary Wharf, so I don't want to pick on that area specifically, but it is an example of people moving away. So I think people's expectations of the cities now has increased, much like it has for the office. But there was a whole narrative, at, you know, 5 years ago where, you know, the city's dead. We're moving to suburban areas, we're going to be in clusters in suburbia, and the 15-minute city can only really exist in these clusters of neighbourhoods. And the more and more conversations I'm having, I think that and the more I'm seeing, I don't think that's actually the reality. Cities are very much still vibrant. People still want to be together in person, but it's different. It's not centered around work in the same way it was anymore. It's centered around life and work being a facet of that. Yeah.
There's quite a lot in the press this week about people, the interest in properties and searches for properties in London suddenly back up again in a quite dramatic way, you know, after a long period of far fewer people looking for places in London, which does suggest something around, you know, it's not because they're moving closer to work necessarily. I think it's because they're looking for something that cities have to offer. So what do you see happening in those places? I know there was quite a lot of discussion some years back about kind of repurposing disused office space into residential. Are we actually seeing that happen, or what do we expect from those very kind of concentrated business districts moving forward? Since it's probably likely that even if quite a few people do go back into the office, that the nature of that attendance and the cadence of that attendance is likely to change.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question as well, because we did a kind of a trend report at the beginning of this year where we looked at 8 global cities and we're seeing what's happening with the real estate in those 8 cities. I can recall them off the top of my head now. It was Amsterdam, Dubai, Singapore, London, Tokyo, New York, Buenos Aires, and Melbourne.
Ooh. And wow. I was going to let you off with 4. Yeah. So.
But within that, we saw kind of subsections of what was happening there. So we had some, you know, the really innovative cities that are thinking about smart infrastructure, and they're starting to build the infrastructure for autonomous vehicles and built on data. And they're more kind of new cities like Singapore and Dubai, and even the buildings in Amsterdam, they're thinking very innovatively about environmental and ESG and those sorts of things. Then we had kind of evolving cities like London and Tokyo. They've got a lot of legacy real estate, but a lot of legacy policies as well. They're incredibly old cities. So how do you marry policy with environment, with people, with real estate? So they're kind of evolving their process. They can't do anything radical and completely build a whole new city because they've got a lot of legacy infrastructure. And then we had some cities that we deemed to be slightly more resilient. So Melbourne has the highest vacancy rates in Australia at the moment, and I think their vacancy rates are sitting at around 20%. And so they've got a lot of reimagining to do in that city. How do they make that a resilient place to be where people want to be? And so they are completely trying to reimagine their CBD, their district, and they're looking at things like green corridors. They're looking at activating kind of public spaces within office spaces. So there's much more for the public and not just for the private land and the workers. New York is another interesting one. You mentioned office to resi conversions. That seems to be something that I've seen and maybe most maturely here. I know I previously worked at Gensler for the Research Institute. I know this is something that they are really focusing on, but they did a piece of research and they said actually it's the worst office buildings that make the best houses, because they have, you know, smaller ceilings or like lower down ceilings, their floor plates aren't as big, they make the best houses. So actually that offers a prime opportunity to take some of that B and C building stock and turn that into some fantastic housing. You know, my personal opinion on that is a lot of those buildings aren't in the locations you want to be in. So you can convert them into amazing houses, but if they're in the outskirts of the city and the public transport's really bad, are you going to want to live there? I don't know. But it's possible. And then they're looking into the kind of office to resi conversions. And I think it's a really interesting opportunity. But I think there's other opportunities to convert, you know, old building stock into activating them in different ways maybe than for housing.
And I think the 15-minute city explored that. I know it's a bit of a taboo phrase now because it was tabled and then almost had a backlash, didn't it? I suppose, not saying we're going back to that, but is that an opportunity, like you say, for that stock to create a new area, not to live, work and do absolutely everything, but almost create something completely new?
Yeah, I would say so. And yeah, the 15-minute city had its moment and then it had its flowers taken away from it a little bit. But I think the premise of it was accessibility. It wasn't saying you can get from one end of London to the other in 15 minutes. It was never about making places smaller. It was about having access to key foundational human needs like education, like hospitals, like work, yeah. But amenities as well. And so people, you know, just want convenience at the end of it. You know, it's kind of a big barrier to going into the office is the commute that you have to do, the inconvenience of leaving your house. You have to have something really exceptional on the other side. And I think that's, you know, what the 15-minute city is, the local city, whatever you want to call it. Being in an area where you feel so connected to a community and you feel so like everything is very conveniently accessed and located for you, that's a draw. That's a draw to the office. That's a draw to where you live in the city as well.
And I think the you know, they've got rise in loneliness, the highest mental health stats and things like that. I think this whole increase in the need for meaningful communities is stronger than ever, right? That, you know, for Gen Z and future work, well, just generations, not just the workforce, I think that's clearly, it's so needed from society.
Yeah, and I think if we are removing the workplace as a place where we get to have those meaningful connections, then what is it that sort of replaces those spaces, right? And I think, you know, historically, we look back at things like churches or pubs, or that's kind of like two opposite ends of the spectrum, but, you know, places where we used to get people together that were dedicated environments just for that purpose, really, just to convene people, right, around a common sense of values or purpose or whatever it is. And I think we've lost a lot of that over the years, and maybe the workplace has actually filled in some of those gaps. And now as that moves away, what are those new community spaces that we're going to have? Are we, you know, what, when we look at the future of the high street, where are people getting together? It can't just be about shops and sort of transactional type things. I mean, it's a question if even shops are somewhere we want to be anymore, but yeah, what do we do with all this space where we need to bring people together? What is the purpose of that space? And then I guess the next question is, how does then planning and government support the creation of those spaces?
I wish I had the answer to that question. But it's true. What brings people together isn't necessarily what it was in, 10, 15 years ago, even 5 years ago. And you mentioned churches. That's really interesting because that's a huge community for a certain generation now. And actually, religion has sort of tapered out throughout generations more generally. And so it's not the congregational place that it once was. And shops aren't really a meeting space. There's a bit, you can generate a bit of buzz there. It's, you know, coffee shops and things. I think it's activating spaces and creating new experiences for people. And I do think it's going to have to be some combination of a digital, physical blend in spaces where people feel that they can connect and dial into spaces through digital means as well. And in retail, they've been speaking about the omni-channel retail experience since the early 2000s. And I wonder, maybe that's what our, you know, we need to start thinking about life in cities in that same way as well. And think about, okay, how can we blend the two? I don't have the answer to that, but, you know, you look at, if I talk very generically about a generational divide here, and I'll have Gen Z sort of biting my head off, same with millennials, but a lot of Gen Zs who are on social media are interacting and making a lot of their connections who they feel very close to online, people that they've never met, but they have whole communities of people exclusively online that they feel very connected to in their own way. In the same way that maybe millennial or Gen X wouldn't feel the same connection to those people. We have social media, we have those digital networks as well, but our default has been to meet in person and to congregate in person, and that's how we make connections and meaningful interactions. So I wonder if there's something in there as new generations come up with different technologies, the way that they interact with the city might be quite different as well. And I don't think that we've had enough time to see how that's going to materialize. I think there's always going to be a need for human connection, but I wonder if there'll be something that's a slightly more blurring the lines between digital and physical that creates a bit more of a community feel.
Yeah, it makes me think about all the kids I see, young people I see filming TikTok videos, but in like public spaces. So doing kind of dances in public spaces where they're filming for TikTok, but there's a crowd around, you know. And I think that is actually sort of to your point, right? Is like those spaces like parks and things like that, kind of open public spaces, the plaza, the, you know, the kind of boulevard type environment where people are generally more likely to meet up or to sit out and have a coffee on the pavement or whatever. Are those spaces going to become much more kind of digitized, but also have this in some ways become both digitized and nostalgic at the same time, right? So there's a throwback to those spaces that we used to convene. That AI is going to threaten, I guess would be the word, a lot of the kind of cultural output and creative output from those industries. So where can they actually carve out something that feels valuable in the context of what is, you know, potentially sort of threaten creativity online? Does that make sense?
Yeah, completely. But I think I also think AI can create an opportunity to help create spaces that people want. So we speak a lot about the personalized experience in offices, but actually can our experience be more customized to the cities and the places that we go as well? And I did a case study of a really interesting company last month. They're called Placemaking AI, and they've worked with the Crown Estate on all of their retail spaces in the City of London. And they basically collect all of the data from sort of Google reviews and Instagram output, like any sort of digital footprint that people are sort of posting on spaces. They're all anonymized and the ethics behind it is quite robust, but they will collect all of that data. And then they start to create these AI-driven personas. So, and then those AI personas become sort of ChatGPT. You can ask them questions like ChatGPT. So you might have someone that's like, I'm a teenager living in the city. I come to, or I live outside the city. I come on the weekends and blah, blah, blah. You can say, okay, well, what would you like to do on the weekends? And then the AI, based on all of the data that it has, will respond on kind of key things that they've been doing. And then you can start to tailor the spaces to start to predict and start to predict what people will want when they come into those spaces and have spaces that are much more responsive to evolving needs rather than creating these high streets like Oxford Street, which are thriving until the pandemic hit. And then suddenly they seem not obsolete. That's not the right word, but definitely less of a attractive place to do your shopping. So it's having that adaptability in the spaces as well to evolve to different expectations. I think that will be something that will be really interesting in the future. I don't think we're quite there yet.
It's really interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I remember hearing some stats around the way that boys and girls use park spaces, and boys are much more likely to go into the middle of it, play basketball, play, you know, do the kind of sport thing in the middle. And girls are very much more likely to hang out at the edges where they can see the entrances, whether it's conscious or not. And so actually even be able to address some of those, you know, inbuilt issues would be quite interesting. I'm going to ask you a question now about something I completely don't understand. So if it sounds like I don't know what I'm talking about, that's because it's true. But I've seen some things, because I don't fully get it, but some things around kind of creating digital twins for cities. So almost what you're talking about, where basically you can create personas, but then you can actually design the city and then see how those personas interact with the space before you actually embed it in the city. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So I wouldn't want to speak specifically for that company, but it is possible, yes, to do something like that. So you can simulate a couple of different scenarios, a couple of different people in the space, see how they would interact with the space, ask questions, say, why isn't this working? Have someone that's basically interacting with you. And then, yeah, it's basically a digital twin where you can then manipulate the space in a digital world before you spend any sort of investment doing it in the physical world. And as I'm talking, it does sort of sound like, okay, are we just going to stop asking people what they actually want now? And we're just going to solely rely on AI? And I don't think that's the point of it. I think it's more, yeah, we still want everyone to have their say. And they are having their say because they're writing these things in reviews and online. And that's how the data is collected. But I think it's taking data that would initially be ignored or read by some and few and making that meaningful in the urban design and the layout of the city. So they gave a specific example of German Street in Soho. They found actually, like, it was traditionally very kind of suits and work clothes, and they were like, actually a lot of people who are shopping in this prefer kind of leisure wear. And so they were thinking, okay, should we like put in a kind of leisure shop? And they were looking for different experiences, so they had these kind of arcades, and then they redesigned how they were thinking about those, and then they had an uptick on traction in that area of different people. So they are able to measure the success of their spaces, like, you know, pretty instantly, and adapt them. And I think it's quite amazing. I mean, I I won't pretend that I fully understand the technology behind it, but I do understand the kind of capabilities of it. And I think it will be part of an ingrained part of urban planning in the future.
Bear with me here. So going on to workplace planning. So we know that employees are the most disengaged they've ever been. There's tons of data and articles around that at the moment. Well, you mentioned earlier that the hybrid models aren't working, but being asked for because there's no blueprint, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm wondering, I mean, this has probably already been created somewhere, but has somebody taken feedback, like you say, that is out there and publicly available and flipped it into how to create the blueprint for hybrid or find the way for it to work to then improve employee engagement and that interaction with employees and companies? Because that then has the knock-on effect of Gen Z with their trust in brands, because we, you know, we've touched on there's a rise in self-employed work versus the wages that you was a term that you taught me in our discovery call. And I'm just wondering, is that the direction that this is going or could go to improve employee engagement that would then probably have a knock-on effect on things like mental health, well-being, etc.?
Absolutely. When I initially saw that case study, I thought this could be revolutionary for the workplace. A lot of organizations already have much of this data. Many organizations do annual surveys. They collect data on occupancy. They have ticketing data for facilities. They already have so much data, but teams are siloed. There's so much they don't know what to do with it. You kind of get analysis paralysis and, you know, things like that, that actually that data ends up staying there or only a small facet of it gets used for a certain purpose. And so I think by bringing it all into a round and creating personas in your individual workspace, and because it's based on data, it can be very flexible. So one blueprint doesn't necessarily have to work for another organization or even another office in the same organization, because you're basing the data on people who are frequently using the space. And I think it could improve engagement in terms of the personalized experience that you get. And we're already seeing this with some workplace apps and technologies like Microsoft Viva Insights. They'll look at who's talking to who and start creating, not, you know, moving away from the traditional org chart and starting to look at things like relationship-based working and project-based working and things like that. And they'll collate all of that data into an app, and it will say, look, I can see that you've been speaking to Dan and Alice. Why don't you go and sit with them today? They're both in the office. They're here. And then not only will the app sort of say where they're sitting, but there's also capabilities to do wayfinding to that spot now. And so the technology is there to make an experience so personalized and to help engagement rise. But that's, again, that's the capabilities of it, not necessarily the reality of it right now. I still think there's a lot of work to be done inside an organization in terms of cleaning that data and understanding it, having the right roles in place, you know, again, in New York at the moment, it seems to be very siloed in some of these large organizations. You have real estate, IT, HR, and that they've all got different agendas, and then we're seeing a rise of the kind of the workplace experience, chief workplace experience officer, whatever you want to call that role, trying to bring them all together. And so I think there are efforts happening, but there's so much potential for personalized experiences and you know, increasing the engagement. But having said that, in terms of the engagement piece, I think that's really interesting, because I'm sure you would have seen Gallup's survey last week, maybe the week before, where they've released their 2025 results. And for the first time since the pandemic, we've seen a dip in engagement again. And that's exclusively because of middle management. It's their engagement has declined so much that it's brought down the entire kind of average. And I think that piece is because, to your point, hybrid is hard. They are managing the expectations from the C-suite, saying we want, you know, we've got our business best interest at heart. We think that means bringing people back to the office. We think culture X, Y, and Z. You need to get your teams back to the office. Then they have directly their employees saying to them, but my mental health, my well-being, my autonomy, you're taking things away from me. I'm now discontent. And so they're like really at this bridge where they and no one's taught them how to manage that, and no one we're kind of at a crossroads, I think, with leadership now, where we need some serious kind of radical rethinks about what leadership looks like in a hybrid world, because no one's done it before and people are struggling.
I have been in that position personally, where managing up and managing down, and it's or when it jars against your own beliefs as well, and managing all these expectations. And like you say, there's no blueprint, but you're trying to navigate your way through it with what feels right. We've got such polarizing generations in the workforce at the moment, and like Gen Z are the future leaders, right? So what is that going to look like in a very short space of time? Again, I feel like we're going to go through another big flip, turbulent time.
I agree. There's a really interesting model that we touched on at White Tech Academy, but it was actually coined by a guy called Rama Guerrero. I butchered his last name there. I hope he's not listening. But he was the director of the Helen Hamlin Center for Design at the Royal College of Art. He came up with this framework for leadership that was centered around clarity, empathy, and creativity. And I think it's very interesting if you were to look at that from a generational level. I think more traditional and more traditional hierarchical structures, clarity is the dominant trait for a leadership. It's quite, it's command and control. I'm very clear about my messaging, but it was a bit tyrannical. And you kind of have millennial leaders moving up. They've experienced that, and so they've come with a lot of empathy, and they want to understand everyone and make sure that everyone's happy and trying to manage all of these things. And then I think what we will see now with the younger generation is a bit more creativity in leadership, which I don't think we've seen. And we obviously there's innovative leaders and things like that, but creativity in this context is a bit more like, how can we think outside the box? How can we, I see your point, but I'm gonna take it over here and let's just play around over here for a bit and experiment with things. And so I think and Rama's model essentially was saying we need all three of those in a leadership capacity. As I said, too clear, you become a tyrant, too empathetic, you become a pushover, and too creative, you're kind of a bike without a chain, just pedaling, 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 getting nowhere. So you do need all three of those, but I think each generation almost has a defining characteristic that we've seen. And maybe now we just need to bring it all together in the round and think, okay, where's the opportunities to be empathetic, but where do we also need to be clear? And where can we experiment with it? And maybe that's right. I thought that was a really nice framing of a model for the leadership now, because you do need all three of those components.
Yeah, that's interesting. And actually, it references a lot of the topics that we've discussed on here as well, doesn't it, Dan? I wanted to return back to the topic of wellness, because I've done a little bit of work in this, and I know that we've seen definitely a rise in investment in wellness initiatives by different organizations. But there was a study at the beginning of the year from Oxford University that talked about the fact that a lot of those initiatives just aren't working, right? So people are happy to take them up, but actually they don't meaningfully shift the dial in terms of people's actual engagement and feeling better and healthier. Just wanted to see what your thoughts were on where that solution is falling short.
That's a really interesting question, because we've spoken about a bit about, I think I mentioned it earlier in this call, the wellness gloss. And I think that's at the moment a lot of where the wellness initiatives sit at the moment is this superficial gloss over work. So instead of addressing the problem of burnout, stress, disengagement, they will say, okay, you're feeling stressed, we bought you a Headspace app. And it's like, but no, it's the meetings, it's the management, it's the training, it's all of that that's making me stressed. But that requires some digging into, some investment and some time. And actually, it's much easier to just buy a wellness app, a meditation app for everyone, and it's cost effective and things like that. And I'm not saying those apps aren't great as well. There's certainly a place for them, but it's not addressing the root cause. So I think there seems to be, and also there are a lot of surveys where employers will actively ask their employees, what do you want? What would help your wellness? And if you just ask them what you want, they will give you a better version of what they already know. Whereas instead, if you came to them and you said, what's wrong? How are you feeling? What's not working? Where's your well-being suffering at the moment? You'll get much richer insights and you'll be able to actually make some very meaningful decisions around where well-being can be helped. And, you know, there's lots of models looking at the spectrum of well-being. You've got psychological, financial, social, physical. And, you know, you can argue that the workplace can't solve for everything. But, certainly in the physical environment, your office has a huge impact. If you're spending 8 hours a day there, ergonomic furniture, there's some foundational things, ergonomic furniture, a bit of biophilia, you know, some plants in there, some natural light, you know, air quality, things like that, that we know will improve employees' perception of their workplace, but also their health. You know, financial well-being, obviously as an employer, you're paying the salary. That doesn't mean you need to pay everyone more, but it's okay. There's some educational programs. Is there something we can do to help people invest their money, make their money work better for them? You know, are there some speakers we can bring in? You know, I think there are certain things that if you actually identify where the issue is within your organization in terms of wellness, you can start to meaningfully solve those problems rather than just saying, you know, you get medical insurance and an app and, you know, hopefully that will be fine.
Yeah, tick. We do often miss, and as a marketer, we always go back to that. You know, sometimes you can go storming off in one direction, you know, with energy and motivation, all of those things. And sometimes you step back and go, we actually ask what people want. And that's from an internal or even your client-facing perspective. We've spoken to them and just asked them. It's that really simple thing of human to human, ask them, and then you can build it around that.
Yeah. What are some of the big research topics that you have coming up, that whether you have them coming up or things that you know you'd like to have coming up once you had the ability to pursue any kind of research project you wanted to?
That's such a good question. But at the moment, I'm conducting some research on the legal workplace, which has proved to be a fascinating and scary place to be, because I'm doing it on both the US and the UK side. Very different beast. Everything I thought I knew about the workplace doesn't apply to legal in some way, shape, or form or capacity. They like to think they're very unique. They are unique, but that's been a really interesting research project, and we're kind of only just scratching the surface with that. So I'm diving into that in the next few months. So that's very, I'm genuinely very excited about that project. And then some of the things I think I would like to do more research on is, and it sounds a bit dry, but I'd like to do some research on sort of road mapping and blueprinting some of the things that we're talking about. That would be my ideal. If we could get to a common understanding of some of these things that we're talking about today, like, you know, hybrid, for example, or even, you know, I've been in conversations with someone who's conducting work into smart buildings now. And the term smart building is so ambiguous that if we were talking about, well, can we put some perimeters around it? Can we create a bit more of a blueprint and a common understanding of what some of these terms that we use every day mean? And so we're all at least starting on a baseline, a common language. And I think that's what we're lacking at the moment, is a real common language between different departments, different industries. And therefore, we're all using the same words, but in very different ways and context. So I'd love to do some research that allowed me to place a bit of a stake in the ground in some of these big terms that we're using today.
And how is all the research that you do and the different topics that you looked into, how does it shape your personal understanding of work right now and what motivates you at work?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think I've always approached work with I've always been a bit of a go with the flow person, and I was like, this is a really interesting topic for me from a journalistic perspective, but now it seems to be ingrained, the conversations I have at work seem to be ingrained in my personal life as well. I'm talking to my friends about this at the pub and things like that, and my partner as well. He's a civil servant, and you know, we would I had them on a call and they were talking about going back to the office, and I sat there kind of rolling my eyes and I was like, but why do they want you to go back to the office? What reasons have they given? What's going on there? And he was like, oh yeah. So we like have these big kind of debates just in my household now of kind of like, what's the reason? Why are you going back? What do you feel? So I think in terms of the whole RTO debate, that's happening in my personal and my work life, and it's completely reshaped that. But I've been very fortunate throughout the entirety of my career to have a lot of autonomy over where and when I work. And I think I've had a brand new appreciation for that in amidst all of these conversations, because I can very easily blend my work and life together and separate it when I want to as well.
Is there anything that really excites you about like the next couple of years? I don't want to say pin anything on a prediction as such, but I think, as you mentioned earlier, it's been such a turbulent 5 years. What's exciting you about the next couple of years in the term, you know, in terms of cities and work?
I think it's the potential of data and AI to come into our life in a really meaningful way. I'm both very excited and a little bit terrified by it, but mostly excited. I tend to have a very optimistic view on AI and what we can do with it. And I think in terms of that personalization of experiences, we welcome that in our apps, on our phone, in our daily life so readily, but we seem to have this hesitancy when it comes to work and external things we're a little bit unsure about. But I think as we progress, that line will blur a bit more and we'll welcome those more personalized experiences. And, you know, the more data that's collected and the more we can use that in meaningful ways, I think it creates a really exciting opportunity for urban design, but also for the way that we live our lives. We can make things a lot easier for ourselves. We can be a lot more efficient with our time and optimize our kind of, you know, output, and, you know, hopefully have a better life. I have a very utopian view, I know, but but I do feel optimistic about the potential of AI. And I know I should feel threatened. I'm a writer, I'm a researcher. My job is, you know, very publicly declared, you know, that it's going to, you know, not exist in a few years because of AI. But, you know, I'm embracing it at this stage of my career, and I hope to continue embracing it and working with it and, you know, creating something that's different and interesting. And that's, yeah, if I don't have that view, I think I would be a very pessimistic person, a very sad person.
Two more questions. One's hopefully a simple one. Out of you research into cities, which city do you love the most for the, you know, the way in which which city do you love the most?
Well, I have to say London. I'm a London girl.
Yeah.
I think London's very interesting. I don't think it's the most innovative. I don't necessarily you know, think it's the most vibrant of the cities, of all the cities, but I do think it deals very well with some legacy infrastructure. There are exciting projects that's happening. There's always an appetite for new things in London, whether they happen or not. I think there's a general excitement around the city. So I'll say London because it's home, and I do think there's some great projects happening there at the moment.
Thank you. And then my other question is, what topic do you think we should explore on the podcast in season 3?
You've already covered some very, very great topics. I listened to the podcast on AI, and you've covered generational things that we've mentioned today. And you've covered the 4-day work week. You know, I'd like to see something on kind of maybe like innovation districts. So that feels very left field, but it's an area that we've sort of looked into at the moment. It plays into the city side of thing, but it's you know, it's these really intentional spaces like Stratford Place, and we've been doing some work with Lendlease on kind of what an innovation district is, and bringing that really is kind of a microcosm of bringing work and life and innovation together in one place. And there's some really amazing projects. I think that could be quite an interesting deep dive into what an innovation district even looks like and what that is.
Great. That sounds really good. Not one that we've thought of.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being today and for taking time out of your trip to see us.
People can find me at worktechacademy.com. That is where all our research is housed. That is how you can get in touch. And it's a great kind of breeding ground for some of these subjects that we've spoken about today.
Amazing.
Perfect.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Really Bye. Enjoyed this. Bye.
And thank you to everyone for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the episode. If you have any Work is Weird moments to share, please find us on LinkedIn and let us know what they were. In the meantime, have a wonderfully weird week, and we look forward to seeing you next time.